The Right Question is funded by the Steele Reese Foundation, by Humanities Montana, and by listeners like you.
Why is Idaho's Salmon River unique?
Idaho's Salmon River is unique in a variety of ways, but I guess the most important to this book is that it is the last long, wild, free river in the lower 48 states. There are other long, free rivers, as in undammed, and there are wild rivers. But put all that together, a long river, over 400 miles long, wild as in running through country that's almost completely undeveloped, and for a span running through the largest contiguous wilderness complex remaining in the lower 48 states, and then this river itself is completely undammed. That is unique.
Welcome to The Right Question, a program that features writers from the Western U.S. I'm Cherie Newman. Joe Durbrock is my guest this time, and we'll be talking about her book, Anything Worth Doing, a true story of adventure, friendship, and tragedy on the last of the West's great rivers. Winner of a 2012 National Outdoor Book Award. Well, let's begin by saying that you were a river guide for 12 years and that this book tells a true and very well-researched story in which two men, river guides Clancy Reese and John Barker, set out to accomplish feats that, well, to me anyway, seem insane. What insight can you give us into why they would do things like travel the Columbia River from its source to the Pacific Ocean in a small boat, or raft the Salmon River during its highest water?
I think they lived what they loved, and that's what I admire about them. The first time I ever heard a phrase that encapsulated that same idea was in Joseph Campbell's book on mythology and the modern man, and he said, follow your bliss, right?
Mm-hmm.
These guys, they followed their bliss, or in my words, they lived what they loved. And what they loved was rivers, and they were incredibly competent on rivers. And I think if you take those two facts, that these people loved rivers and they wanted to live what they loved and they were amazingly competent, you're going to end up doing some things that to most of the rest of us look a little crazy.
And their motto is a little crazy also. And that's where the title of the book comes from. I think it came from Clancy Reese, right? Anything worth doing is worth overdoing.
Yes, correct. That was Clancy's line.
And his protege, John Barker, who ended up to be his river running partner, took that maybe a little bit to extremes.
I feel that same way. I try not to draw a lot of conclusions when I write, but that was one of my questions as a writer, was whether that phrase, anything worth doing is worth overdoing, meant the same thing to those two men. And I think for me anyway, as a writer and as a reader of this book myself, I guess I decided that they didn't mean the same thing.
Can you tell us why?
I think for Clancy, anything worth doing is worth overdoing meant something like what I said a minute ago, live what you love, follow your bliss. If it isn't worth overdoing, if you don't love it, don't do it at all. For John, I think he needs to seek his own personal limits as often as he can, in as many ways as he can. And for him, overdoing means that. It means finding his limits and trying to push them.
And finding something that no one else had done before.
Finding something no one else had done before, that most people couldn't do, that even more of us probably shouldn't do, and hardly any of us would want to do.
Yes, that last one. Hardly any of us would want to do. We'll come back to their escapades in a minute, but let's go back to you. What was it like for you to live the life of a river guide? What attracted you to it so much that you did it for 12 years?
I grew up in a family that spent a lot of time outdoors. I'm a native Westerner, and what I remember from childhood is camping, hiking, looking for arrowheads. I'm old, so it was legal back then. And fishing. And so I've always been an outdoor person. But when at age 28, I got invited on my first wilderness raft trip, I fell so in love with rivers, with the river environment, with the with river canyons, and then with just the rhythm of life as lived on, next to, and dependent upon rivers. That trip, my first raft trip, changed my life. It's when I became a guide, and I miss guiding to this day. I've been out of it a decade.
But unlike Reese and Barker, you chose not to continue. What do you think the characteristics or inclinations that those two men possessed, what are the ones that they have that you didn't share?
That was a lot of what I wanted to think about when I was working on the book, and what I wanted other people to be able to think about too. Isn't it true that we all have different tolerances for personal risk and different willingnesses to compromise, and the shapes of our lives are created in no small part by those two things? How big of a risk taker are you, and how much will you compromise on your dreams? And I'm a compromiser. I wanted, medical insurance. I wanted to be able to maybe retire someday. I wanted, a reclining chair.
You wanted some comfort.
I wanted some comforts, and more than that, I'm kind of joking about the comforts, but I definitely wanted some security.
So I'm not giving anything away by saying that Clancy dies in this story, because that revelation comes quite early in the book. But why did his death in particular, many, many people have died on rivers, why did his death affect you so deeply that you've spent all those years researching and writing this book?
Two reasons. One of the reasons is that his death deeply affected a lot of people. And that really made me think. And it made me think about things beyond the events of this story. He was important as an icon, almost as a legend in Idaho rafting at the time. And I found that fascinating. The other reason is because at the time that he died, I was in the middle of thinking about my compromises and what I wanted into the future and how I wanted my old age to look. And I was becoming really uncomfortable with some of the risks I was taking, not so much the physical risks, but the security risks. And then this man that I didn't know very well, but I admired, pays the ultimate price. And it really set me back and made me think hard.
And part of your research process was reading through a box of his papers. It was a box that Clancy's brother gave to you after his death. Describe a little bit about what you found in that box.
I felt like an eavesdropper into a private person's mind going through the stuff in that box. It was poetry, and he didn't revise poetry. He would just rewrite a different version of it. So it would be multiple versions of a poem. It would be odd little aphorisms. They read like the sorts of things you would put on the backs on a bumper sticker. Journal entries, only the journal entries always were written as though to someone, and as I read them, I would always be trying to imagine if they actually were intended for a specific person, or were they for a generic you? Was he thinking about publishing this stuff? A lot of it was written plenty well enough that it could have been early drafts of something the man intended to publish.
And the papers in that box didn't really add up to the image of this really strong man, physically big man, who was this icon in the folklore of the river runners in Idaho.
No, and that was yet another thing that really compelled me toward writing this book. Not only was he kind of a riverbank Thoreau, which was how it seemed to me, you know, reading the stuff he'd written. Not only that, but in college, the guy studied ballet and boxing. Thank you very much. I mean, he was a man that was almost impossible to categorize if you knew anything about him. And I think that's cool.
There was a moment in the story where you were writing about an experience that he had when he was in the military, which involved boxing and ballet, sort of. Tell us about that.
Yes. Yeah, so Clancy was drafted into the Navy during Vietnam, and he's working out in a gym, and a guy comes up to him and says, "Hey, will you spar with my man here? He needs some practice." Clancy says, "I don't really feel like getting beaten up." The guy says, he'll go easy on you. So they start sparring, and Clancy is a man with his own very strong and very personal sense of right and wrong. So Clancy decides this guy is not taking it easy on him. He's really trying to hurt him, and he decides to teach the guy a lesson. The guy moves kind of slow, even though he hits really hard. So Clancy proceeds to just wail him. And after a few minutes of this, the trainer calls it off, says, okay, we're done here. And Clancy is walking away, and the guy says, "Hey, you just beat up the middleweight champion of the Navy. Who are you? And where did you learn to box?" And Clancy says, "Well, I'm no boxer. I'm just a ballet dancer from Idaho."
I love that story.
I did too.
And so we've got this philosopher, poet, guy who's being a river guide. And by the time he sets off on this journey that doesn't end well, he's 50 years old. And he's doing these adventures with a younger man, John Barker. And John is a different kind of person. Describe who John is.
John is driven. John is driven to push his own limits. He's driven to push the limits of the world around him. He likes to study. He likes to study maps. He likes to study numbers. He calls the state hydrologists and pesters them infernally for as much information as he can get on the rivers that he runs. His friend Clancy, meanwhile, would probably be reading or writing poetry, right?
Mm-hmm. So John's more the type A of the team.
Type A double plus, I think.
Yeah, I noticed when they were scheduled to leave, when they were going to do this last run, which was to go as far as they could in a 24-hour period, which they were going to do at high water in order to get the most speed, they were to leave at 8:50 p.m., and they left at exactly 8:50 p.m.
By the watch that John only wears when he's doing things like this.
And when you were interviewing him, you went to his house, and the scene that I remember from the book was just lots and lots of maps.
Lots and lots of maps in that house, and frankly, very little else. The house felt to me like a place that somebody was either in the middle of moving into or in the middle of moving out of, and most of the furniture and all of the personal possessions were already gone, except maps.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Jo Durbrock about her award-winning book, Anything Worth Doing. Right after a short break, we'll hear a passage from the book and talk about Clancy's choice not to wear a wetsuit during his last river trip. Stay tuned. Well, back to Clancy, there's a moment in the book when you speculate very briefly about the course of his life, and that's a passage I'd like you to read.
Okay. So at this point in the book, John and Clancy have been adventuring together for almost 10 years, and they have finally come up with an adventure they think will rival their first, which was, for both of them, idyllic and I think life-changing. Their first adventure was a source to see, starting at the headwaters of Idaho's Salmon River and finishing at the mouth of the Columbia on the Pacific in a dory that Clancy had built for this journey. So 10 years later, they finally come up with a journey they think will be as iconic, for them at least, as this first one. And Clancy has insisted on bringing his dory, and he had to do a bunch of work on it the winter before in order to get it ready for the trip. They're at the put-in. It's evening because they're going to run through the night, and Clancy is standing on shore looking at his dory. Clancy, eyeing his dory, bright white against the high-water brown of the river, must have felt something more complicated, perhaps an ambivalent pride. He was a man of dreams. He wanted to sail this dory down Hell's Canyon's biggest rapids, running the steepest granite at the stroke of midnight. He had inventions to get rich by, business ventures to launch. He made restless plans to fix up the old motorcycle in his shed, make wine from the grapes ripening on his back fence, build a stereo system, write a book. But unlike John, who could not separate dreaming from doing, Clancy found pleasures of the moment at least as compelling as sustained striving. Freedom and dreaming were satisfying in themselves. His friends had learned to expect him mostly when he wasn't expected. When he stayed overnight at their houses, he slept outside, unwilling to give up even the small measure of autonomy that a guest relinquishes in return for hospitality. And although he believed in the sanctity of a man's word and the value of a solid day's work, he might say he'd show up at the Barker warehouse at noon and not arrive until 1 or 2 p.m. or the next day. These things had always been more or less true, but he no longer bore their costs as lightly as he once had, especially the lack of financial security. And there was also this. Clancy would turn 51 in a few days. He occasionally seemed startled at the failings of the middle-aged, increasingly overweight body he now inhabited. It seemed just yesterday that, young and indestructible, silently awhirl with ideas, he'd spent a winter with the wizened hermit of the Salmon River, Sylvan Buckskin Bill Hart. The little man had lived in roadless wilderness at a place called 5 Mile Bar. He'd forged guns and knives, medieval-style armor, and a mini castle. He'd built bridges and two cabins and an irrigation system for his fields. Rafters gave him food and supplies in return for tours and stories. For them, the clever hermit was a novelty. Writers billed him as the last mountain man. But Clancy knew what Hart really was, an expatriate hiding out in his own country. The winter Clancy had stayed with the old man, Hart had helped him forge two knives. They became prized possessions. The men had had a lot in common. Both had earned college degrees they never capitalized on. Both valued their time far too much to trade much of it for money or even for companionship. But the young Clancy Reese had known he didn't want to become Buckskin Bill. He was no expatriate. He liked the American dream, especially its promise of tangible reward for intelligence and motivation. Yet somehow, after all these years, this boat, rough of construction but pretty of line, was the most tangible thing he owned. And it was a thing nobody but a guy like Clancy would want. The rest of it? The uncounted thoughtful conversations and solitary moments, the million perfect casts, monofilament line arcing over the water, the thousands of lovely trout boated, the 100 exquisitely timed runs through Wild Sheep Rapids, the handful of Crackerjack guides he'd trained, who were now training other generations. Those were not things a man could wrap his arms around. So in the end, hadn't he become that old mountain man after all? Proud, but perilously close to extraneous, full of esoteric knowledge, the broader world found colorful more than useful. Perhaps all this had been on his mind through the spring as he worked on the boat, patching, sanding, and painting. Even when it began to look as though he would run out of time to finish his repairs, he insisted on using his dory for this trip, arguing speed, but also rightness. This was the craft that had taken him and John to the sea almost 10 years earlier. He seemed so fixated on his task that people at the Barker warehouse teased him. Mellow Clancy had morphed into driven John. It must have felt good to bring youth back to his dory, a gift he could not give himself. If you've let physical power and prowess be the engine upon which Plan A depends, what do you do when the engine slows? If you are Clancy Reese, you muscle it into obedience. But that won't work forever, and you know it. Just as you know, you never got around to a Plan B.
That's a very small part of the book. And yet, in searching for a reason why this really intelligent, very experienced man would not put on a wetsuit to take this trip, I found that particular passage sort of insightful. I thought, I wonder if unconsciously he was looking at where he was in life and thinking, maybe I will just go out in glory. Do you think that is possible at all?
I have wondered the same thing, and that's why that passage is in there. I hate speculating about the motives of people I can't ask. So that's me asking the question without trying to answer it in the book. But yes, I wondered the same thing.
Yeah, because the other two men who went on the trip had on their wetsuits and they survived.
Not only survived, but came out of the water not particularly cold.
Yeah, and they were both in the water for a long, long time, and they were warm from trying to swim because they had on the right kind of wetsuit. But when they got on the boat, Clancy just took his wetsuit and put it in a compartment.
Right, and if you're not a boater, that might only sound a little bit odd, but for anyone who runs wilderness whitewater, there's a whole series of things that before that moment that make it seem utterly foolish to me. One is, yes, this is an extreme high water trip. The river is high as it gets, maybe 10 times a century. It's massive. A flood stage river is a very different beast from a river in its normal summer flows. Two, wooden dory, not easy to write if it flips. You'll definitely spend some time in the water if anything goes wrong. Three, one boat trip. If anything happens to any of these three guys, the only way they get saved is if they self-rescue to shore or back to the boat. That can take time. Or if their friend can help them, their friends can help them, and that can take time. So there again, you're going to spend time in the water. If you know all those things, then it really seems weird that he didn't wear the kind of thermal protection that would render that cold water almost a non-issue for a period of time.
Mm-hmm. The order of events in the book, some of the choices you made are a little bit unusual. For instance, instead of telling the story chronologically, you placed the funeral scene in the middle. Tell us a little bit about why you decided to do that.
I decided to do that for a variety of reasons. The biggest and the most important to me was that I did not want to write yet another adventure book that has at its payoff, right, at the end, this tearjerker moment where the guy you like dies. It feels cheap to me to turn a man's life into such a simple and really kind of mundane question, like, did he live? So no, he didn't. And I tell you that at the beginning. And I do want to show you the funeral because these people, they rever this man. He is a legend for them. And so I want to show you the funeral that they put on for the guy, but I'm not going to put it at the end as what seems to me kind of a tawdry payoff.
And so anything worth doing won a 2012 National Outdoor Book Award. That has to feel really good.
That felt great. One of the really cool things about writing nonfiction, one of the things I love about it, is that if I get praise or acclaim, like this book won the National Outdoor Book Award, it feels to me like that's my chance to pay back all the people who gave me hours of their time, their critical attention, their heartfelt stories, their dearest and sometimes most painful memories. They shared all this stuff with me, never knowing if anything would come of it. And yeah, I think it's so cool and a little strange that every bit of praise or comment I get, Joe Durbrock, in my mind, it's for this sort of cacophonous room full of people who all worked on this book.
So I'd like to end our session, because we are out of time, with you reading the page at the very beginning of the book.
I love that. So I found this passage in that box of Clancy's writing that his little brother Charles gave me after Clancy's death, 6 years after Clancy's death. Charles called this box of stuff Clancy's doodles. So it was the box of Clancy's doodles, and this was on one of the pages. For 17 years now, I've been a boatman. I take people down whitewater rivers in the West. Through the summer, I pretty much live on the river, set up a kitchen at a different camp each night, lay out a bedroll to sleep on the riverbank, above the river running, below the stars shining. I'm supposed to be there. I feel very much at home, at ease, and comforted, between the songs of the birds and water and the silence of the stones and the canyon.
Joe Durbrock lives in Idaho Falls, Idaho. You'll find more information about her and the book at therightquestion.blogspot.com, as well as book reviews, Monday poems, writing tips, and links to our podcast and Facebook page.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, with help from Barbara Thoreau, Lisa Simon, David Moore, and Kim Anderson. Michael Marsalek, executive producer. Beth Ann Osteen, studio engineer. Music for this program was written and performed by John Floridis. You'll find links to author information, audio, and our Facebook and podcast feeds at therightquestion.blogspot.com. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.